to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. Modern road building and the ancient past seem far apart by any measure, yet highway and other infrastructure projects usually involve excavation to build secure foundations for new facilities, and excavation sometimes reveals surprises, unexpected utilities, and less commonly, ancient artifacts. That's why many infrastructure agencies engage archaeologists to identify and assess, preserve, and protect those artifacts. Talking with us today about the role of archaeology in modern construction is Jim Robertson, who's an archaeologist with the Michigan Department of Transportation. Jim, thanks a lot for taking some time to talk.
A pleasure.
So let me back up to beginnings. What's your education? How did you become an archaeologist, particularly for Michigan DOT?
My academic training began with my master's degree from the University of Illinois, Chicago. And then I went on and pursued a PhD at Michigan State University. And my first job as a professional archaeologist was working for a historic preservation consulting firm based outside of Philadelphia.
Hmm. So your academic training is specifically in archaeology?
Well, it's anthropology, because archaeology is one of the four subdisciplines of anthropology.
Okay. And was your aspiration to get into the kind of work that you're doing right now?
I would say that, like most people going into archaeology, the thought is being a university professor or a university or museum researcher. But as the field has changed over the years, particularly with the National Historic Preservation Act and the need to do the kind of work I do for MDOT, is that more and more professional archaeologists are hired to work in government agencies and in private consulting firms.
Hmm. Interesting change, I suspect important for people who are interested in anthro and archaeology.
Indeed, it is.
So tell us about what you do at Michigan DOT.
Well, I'm the senior archaeologist for the Environmental Services section in the Bureau of Highway Development, and I oversee the MDOT archaeology program. We provide archaeological clearance for MDOT construction projects, and when necessary, we do conduct archaeological investigations with our small in-house staff of three people. For larger projects, we use private archaeological consulting firms. And I'm also responsible for MDOT's project-specific consultation with Michigan Indian tribes regarding possible impacts to sites important to those groups. To give you a sense of the volume of work we do, since January 2009, the MDOT Archaeology Program has reviewed and cleared over 2,000 projects for archaeological impacts. But by avoiding archaeological sites and archaeologically sensitive areas, only 54 projects have actually required survey or monitoring or extra testing. And of these 54 projects, only three have required large-scale excavations before construction could take place, and that's about 0.15% of all the projects that we've reviewed.
So most of your work is anticipatory?
Yes, it is.
And where does that knowledge base come from? I mean, how do you know what's where so that you can avoid what's where?
Well, let me answer that by explaining how we review projects here. Prior to 2008, we reviewed changes in road and bridge design plans as they occurred. But that left us open to situations where major last-minute design changes often led to delays in finalizing the design and letting the contracts, because it would require last-minute review. So since that time, we've shifted to a proactive system of review. And for archaeological impacts, we analyze the general project specifications that the project engineers give us for the project as they develop their designs. And we use our GIS system and other information sources, such as historic maps and locations of previously recorded archaeological sites. In fact, there's over 20,000 in the state of Michigan in the state archaeologist database. And it helps us develop a project-specific predictive model. And what we then do is we identified red flags to avoid, be it a known site or an archaeologically sensitive landform. And we do this in our environmental documents by implementing a series of conditional statements that the design engineer agrees to in advance. And if the scope of work changes, he or she knows that they're going to have to work out a project schedule change to accommodate additional review. So let's say we have a 5-mile-long road reconstruction project. Let's say it's a mill and fill with shoulder widening, but it's not going to impact the ground surface outside the existing toe slope. Within that 5-mile segment, the road crosses a substantial water body that I'll call Backus Creek, just for instance. And let's say in doing our research and developing our predictive model, we see that historical plat maps from the 1860s and 1870s depict a grist mill adjacent, and then looking at more recent maps, it disappears. So that could be a possible archaeological site. We also know that in this hypothetical situation that there's a previously recorded prehistoric village site located downstream from the stream crossing. And it's on a low terrace above Backus Creek. And then we look at the topography and the setting of our bridge crossing, and we realize that all four quadrants of the stream crossing have similar terraces at the same elevation as the one where the village site is located. So we're concerned that ground-disturbing construction outside the Toa Slope might impact this possible grist mill site, and we don't know if it's there or not, and or a possible prehistoric site that may be in the similar setting. So we develop conditional statements that constrain the design engineers for the archaeological impacts. For this project, I would come up with a statement sort of like this. This project will not impact archaeological sites. The project manager in the attached email states that work will not extend outside the existing Toa Slope. However, if the scope of work changes to include a bridge replacement, a bridge widening, and or a bridge pier or abutment replacement, or if the highway is widened beyond the existing Toa Slope within 500 feet of Backus Creek, then additional review of project impacts by the MDOT archaeologists will be required.
So how do you implement that? How do you assure that that's done?
We have environmental review coordinators that follow up on projects on 19 different environmental factors. Archaeology is one of them. And they attend the final reviews periodically that take place as design plans go through the process, from what we call base plans, the first designs, to later versions. And they check for the conditions that have been specified. Also, as the project engineers develop their designs, they're aware of these constraints, and most of the times they will give me a call and say, listen, I've just got orders that after review of the bridge condition, we might need to do some excavating outside the Toa Slope. And so I say, okay, let's talk about what's required. I'll see what we can do to either avoid possible impacts, or if you want freedom in your design, we can do an archaeological survey and determine if there's a site there or not.
So what does that mean? What does that entail?
Well, an archaeological survey, fieldwork typically involves three different kinds of approaches. One would be visual survey, which would be a walkover survey inspecting the ground surface at 50-foot intervals along parallel transects. If we can't see the existing ground surface in woods or it's covered by understory, then we'll dig small pits called shovel tests. And they're about a foot in diameter and 2 feet deep, and we'll excavate those and screen the soils and look for artifacts and then backfill them, recording with GPS any finds that we have. On stream and river floodplains and terraces, and if there is going to be deep excavation for the construction, we will go in with a backhoe and look for deeply buried sites, because over thousands of years, streams flood and deposit sediments on the floodplains and terraces, burying sites sometimes 4, 5, 10, 20 feet deep.
So when you say we, I presume that that means not necessarily a construction crew or construction crew alone, but trained people from your department.
Trained archaeologists, either our small staff or with deep testing or larger projects, we will hire archaeological consulting firms that have much larger teams of people that can do very extensive surveys.
So going back to the process that you follow, it sounds like you're almost entirely dependent on an existing knowledge base of where things are, where things were, and what to look for. How common is it for somebody that's involved in construction to encounter something that is a complete surprise?
Well, one of the things we do is we're also proactive in how we deal with what you're describing. We call an inadvertent find during construction. And we actually have wording in our specification for construction for contractors that indicate that they need to stop if they encounter archaeological remains or human remains or bones of any kind. And we also have developed a construction advisory as well as educational PowerPoints for MDOT's construction engineers to educate them in terms of what to look for and what process to follow so that the project isn't delayed for any reason. We can stop work, but our specifications indicate that the contractor is free under the direction of the construction engineer to move his personnel and equipment to get maximum amount of work done elsewhere while we check out the inadvertent find.
So in a case like that, I can see the possibility that you could delay the schedule and or increase the cost.
That is a definite possibility, but in the 5 projects in which we've had inadvertent finds since 2009, we have not delayed the project because the construction personnel have been able to reallocate their labor and equipment, and usually they are spot finds in a localized area that we can cordon off and deal with in terms of evaluating the archaeological significance and doing what we need to do to make sure we comply with the legislation that we follow.
So whether it's inadvertent finds or anticipated finds, are these more common in urban settings or rural settings or both?
They can happen anywhere. Now, for archaeological sites, people usually think of prehistoric sites, but there are also historic period archaeological sites that can be significant too. So, as I said with my example, a 19th century grist mill or a 19th century inn or a 19th century early frontier cabin, those sorts of things can occur all over the landscape. And logically, you expect to find them not only along rivers, but along roads. So the historic road network helps us identify where there is a higher potential for finding archaeological sites.
What's the disposition of what you find? That is, do you excavate it, extract it, turn it over to someone else?
If we can't avoid impacting an archaeological site, we conduct larger scale excavations. And as I said, we've only done 3 of those since 2009. But the State Archaeologist of Michigan has the responsibility for all archaeology, including excavations and the collections on state-owned lands. So we would hire a consultant to do those excavations. They would do the analysis and report and public outreach about the project. And once that is completed, the collections will be curated at the Michigan Historical Museum in Lansing.
Jim, to what extent is the work of your office driven by federal legislation? You mentioned the National Historic Preservation Act, and I'm sure there's other legislation as well.
Yeah. Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation, it's the particular section that mandates that federal agencies, and in our case, this is the Federal Highway Administration, they need to consider the impacts of projects that they carry out, whether by approval or permit or funding, and how those projects might impact historic properties. So in the Section 106 evaluation process, a historic property can be a prehistoric or historic site, It can be a historic building or a historic structure or a historic object, like a statuary or something. Or it can be a related group of historic properties that are called historic districts. And the ones that we are concerned about are the ones that are either listed on the National Register of Historic Places or they're significant enough that they are eligible for listing on the National Register. Another category of properties are traditional religious and cultural properties important to Indian tribes or Native Hawaiian organizations. They also can be significant based on the criteria that the National Register sets out for these. So on MDOT trunkline projects, the FHWA, Federal Highway Administration, typically provides about 80% of our funding. So MDOT assists FHWA to comply with Section 106 by conducting surveys to identify and then evaluate the significance of historic properties, and in my case, archaeological sites, well in advance of construction. We have to consult with the Michigan State Historic Preservation Office, Michigan Indian Tribes and their tribal historic preservation officers, other stakeholders and interested parties, and in some situations, we even consult with the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation in Washington. So if we can't avoid impacts to a significant archaeological site, as I said before, we will mitigate those impacts by conducting large-scale data recovery excavations. And this is because archaeological sites are really, in terms of the National Register, only significant for the information they contain, so that we can excavate them, get the information that they contain about local, regional, national history or prehistory. And typically, we don't excavate an entire site. Some sites can be huge, but we excavate a sample so that we can obtain and preserve that significant information.
So you preserve the information, you don't have an obligation to save the stuff.
It gets curated at the History Museum.
Okay. So during your time at Michigan DOT, what's the most interesting thing that you found or that you learned through this process that you described?
Well, we look at and evaluate sites, and one of the more interesting sites, actually, we did some excavations this spring near the city of Midland. It is the proposed scheduled construction in 2018 of a new bridge over the Tittabawassee River, which flows right past downtown Midland. And we originally found the site in 2013. We consulted with the state archaeologist, and he agreed that it was significant enough to be eligible for the National Register in 2014. And knowing this, we sought to minimize impacts to the surrounding environment, and specifically with the archaeological site, by keeping the project as close to the original alignment of the existing road and bridge as possible. But we still couldn't avoid impacting that site. And so to recover the data, we did excavations over a period of 8 weeks. We hired a consulting firm to come in and do them for us. And we recovered evidence of intact archaeological deposits in a stratified, that is, a layered deposit over the years, with the earliest occupations being 4,000 years ago. And we are quite excited and interested in what the analysis and detailed studies. So the consultant will be doing detailed analysis on projectile points, the way in which chipstone tools were used, the style of the pottery. They'll be doing a special process called flotation, in which they took soil samples from the deposits, and they will dry those soil samples and then put them through a process called flotation, in which they're put back in water and heavier artifacts sink to the bottom and charred plant remains will float to the top. And we can find things as little as tobacco seeds that are about, they're almost microscopic in size. And so we can reconstruct the diet. We can reconstruct the season that the occupation took place, and we can better understand how the people who inhabited this site over the years set themselves up on the landscape to take advantage of different kinds of resources, whether it be wild rice, deer or lake sturgeon that would be located in proximity to the archaeological site.
So where is that documented? Presumably there's a written product that somebody can look at.
Yes, there is a full-blown archaeological research report that is the outcome of all the analysis and the detailed studies. And this is produced and distributed to local institutions, the State Historic Preservation Office. It's a limited distribution report. But what we also do, and this is encouraged by the Section 106 regulations, is we do outreach as well, and sometimes that might involve a more popular report as opposed to the larger academic-style report. On one project that we did and are still working on, we excavated three archaeological sites in Ottawa County near the Grand River. And we partnered with six Michigan Indian tribes, and we are now developing lesson plans based on the archaeological information we got and relating them to historical and current Michigan Indian tribes, their culture, their economy, how they are working to restore wild rice to lakes and rivers in Michigan, because we found evidence of wild rice at these sites. And so we're putting together lesson plans that will be for third graders, where Michigan history is taught, and for fifth graders, where prehistoric civilizations are taught. And so we're going to make them available for public, private, Native American schools. We're making available statewide so that people can understand that the archaeological information is not just interesting, but it's also a tool that can be used in learning and education.
So you can learn something from this, if you will, ancient history that has relevance for today, both for information and perhaps for the way people behave and operate and function today.
Indeed, exactly.
So it's particularly interesting to talk to you because one of the things we like to cover in the infrastructure show is things about infrastructure that people don't much think about, the connections that may be behind the scenes or less obvious, but still are important. And so the sensitivity that you bring to this process of infrastructure rehabilitation and construction, I think, is interesting, different, and I appreciate your educating us about it today.
Well, I greatly appreciate the opportunity to tell my story.
Thank you very much. It's very good to talk to you today, Jim.
Okay, thank you.